When he worked at UBS in Geneva, Switzerland, private banker Bradley C. Birkenfeld helped the ultra-wealthy hide their millions from the eyes of authorities. And then one day he chanced upon a memo that outlined how he was going to be personally blamed by the bank for his clients' indiscretions and illegal activities, so he decided to blow the whistle on the largest tax fraud scheme in history. He spent 30 months in prison, but after the IRS collected $15 billion, they gave him a reward of $104 million. He recounts the whole story in a book from C.S. Lewis and Company called Lucifer's Banker, The Untold Story of How I Destroyed Swiss Bank Secrecy. And I'm very pleased it has brought Bradley Birkenfeld to our show today. Hello.
Well, hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You have dedicated your book to your brother, Doug, who's a lawyer. Was he able to help you once you decided to become a whistleblower?
He was instrumental in helping me be the most successful whistleblower in U.S. history for the largest and longest tax fraud.
You have told the story kind of in flashback. You begin with the ride from your hotel in Scranton, Pennsylvania to the Schuylkill Federal Correctional Institution. At the beginning of your 3-year jail sentence, did you wonder at the time if you had done the right thing?
Well, it's always hard to reflect back, but I think now looking at the situation, you can see how the corruption within the Department of Justice really undermined my whole attempt to do the right thing and help the American people recover all these billions in tax fraud.
You're one of three boys, the son of a respected neurosurgeon in Boston. I'm assuming he wanted you all to become doctors. How did you get into banking?
Well, I'm the youngest of the three, and I just sort of stumbled into it when I came out of college as a summer intern, and I just moved my way through the investment banking in Boston, and then I went to Switzerland to get my master's and got involved in private banking.
One of your first jobs was at State Street. What is State Street?
State Street Bank was one of the largest institutional pension fund managers in the country. And I worked for them trading currencies for the underlying portfolios of these pension plans.
During the go-go 80s?
Late 80s, early 90s, exactly.
And during your time at State Street, you began working with international money managers. What does that involve?
Well, the international money managers actually handled the stocks and bond portfolios of our clients, and we managed billions of dollars for these pension plans so that their retirement funds could be successful when their employees wished to retire.
It was after a loss of $750,000 in the international currency markets that you first chanced upon some illegal activity at State Street. It involved something called paddling. What's paddling?
Well, what happened here was they were fixing some currency trades and wrongfully and illegally applying them to clients without taking the blame. And I actually witnessed this, and I objected to it.
Isn't that what banks always seem to be doing, not taking the blame?
Unfortunately, yes. And I think there's a big problem where they generally write checks and walk away. And it's a big problem.
You began keeping records of the illegal activities you witnessed. Were you keeping them so you could expose them or to protect your butt?
Well, I didn't have any guilty part in that ploy. But keeping documents is always instrumental because otherwise people just say you don't know what you're talking about or they'll try to blame you.
But then when you reported the misconduct you had found to your superiors, didn't they fire you?
Ultimately, they fired me for reasons that were unjustified. But that's the way it works. You're a young single male and you get fired, you have no recourse.
And then you went to the FBI.
I went to the same FBI office that was actually protecting Whitey Bulger in Boston. So you can imagine this office was hardly a pillar of stability.
And so they didn't help you?
To the contrary, they covered it up. And they helped the big bank hide these losses and this illegal conduct.
And then, as you said earlier, you went to Switzerland to get an MBA.
I did. I went to Switzerland to get a master's in finance, and I enjoyed it very much there.
How did you come to meet Dr. Rito Caligari? I mean, you know Dr. Caligari is the villain of a movie called The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
That's correct. I don't think there's any relation, but Dr. Caligari was the head of the private bank for Credit Suisse in the French-speaking part of Switzerland. And he really admired my skills and my fortitude, and he offered me a job to work for him.
So you went to work for Credit Suisse?
Initially, right out of school, on my master's program, I worked for Credit Suisse in Geneva.
And that's where you learned about private banking. Does banking differ much in the United States and Europe?
Oh, considerably. In Switzerland, not anymore because of my whistleblowing, but bank secrecy laws are extremely powerful in Switzerland. And what they do is protect the identities of all their clients.
Because you're not supposed to. Secrecy is really important. Did you sign anything that said you would keep all the secrets?
No, it's part of their constitution, actually. Article 47 of the Constitution in Switzerland forbids anyone from giving up any information, any names to any third party.
One of your first encounters with the owners of private Swiss accounts was while you were covering for a colleague named Carol. What happened there?
Yes, I was covering for one of my colleagues at Credit Suisse, and actually two gentlemen came in to withdraw money out of the bank, out of their bank accounts, and they were priests at the Vatican.
Uh-huh. And is there anything illegal about that?
I would think so, because unless the funds were accounted for, but these were in secret Swiss numbered accounts, and these two priests came up from the Vatican to withdraw those funds.
I thought the Vatican had its own bank. How much business is done with the Vatican?
Well, it's hard to say because the Vatican, obviously, the secrecy within the Vatican and the banks there work in hand with the Swiss banks. So you wouldn't want to put all your money in one bank in one city.
And there's been a scandal at the Vatican Bank recently, and whistleblowers there were punished.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is the problem. Whistleblowers inherently get perpetrated as the bad guy, and you have to embrace them, not punish them.
My guest is Bradley C. Birkenfeld. His book, Lucifer's Banker, The Untold Story of How I Destroyed Swiss Bank Secrecy. It is published by, who's the publisher?
Greenleaf Publishing.
And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How much money what's the minimum amount you need to go to a private banker?
Well, in Switzerland, generally the minimum account size was $1 million. And from there, the account would grow or they would bring more assets or invest those assets. So quite frankly, you had a very prestigious group of clientele within the bank, and that's why they managed so much money worldwide.
You left Credit Suisse for Barclays. Why?
Well, Dr. Caligari had left my boss, and he went to Singapore, so I elected to stay in Geneva. And my next boss, after a few months, went to Barclays, which is normal. You go to other competitors. And he brought me with him to work at Barclays Bank in Geneva.
Now, Barclays is a British bank, but do they also bank through Swiss rules when they're in Geneva?
They do. And any bank, any foreign bank or Swiss bank within Switzerland is a Swiss entity, which is covered by the Swiss bank secrecy laws that were in place after Hitler came to power in 1933.
And they put them into place to protect Nazi money?
Well, I think they put it in for a variety of reasons. The main reason was that Adolf Hitler had said that if you move any money, a pfennig, out of the country, you can be shot. So Switzerland countered and said, we will put in secrecy laws where we will not disclose or divulge any client.
There are most banks have some offices here in New York. What about Switzerland? Do they all have outposts there?
Well, there's a few American banks that have offices in Switzerland, but the big Swiss banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, certainly have offices here, even in New York. And they were actually part of the crime, but they were never prosecuted for that. They were given a deferred prosecution agreement because of their close political ties to the Bush and Obama administrations.
Is the whistleblowing usually about institutions or individuals?
Well, it covers, it's really about the individuals. Whistleblowing is so paramount to our society to weed out waste, fraud, and corruption.
But the reason I asked is that since the banks are enabling this, shouldn't they be affected?
Well, they should be, but the problem is, as I said before, they're too powerful. And what they do is just write a check to walk away. So it sets a bad precedent, and there's no deterrent.
You began soliciting money at Barclays from the United States and Canada. What did that involve?
Well, what it was we had an existing book of business, and you would generally go see those existing clients to see if they would bring more monies, or you would go out and farm, quote-unquote, for new clients.
Are these cold calls?
Well, not pure cold calls like you would think like a broker in, say, New York, but you would go to high-end events, and you would see very wealthy people who might be interested to put some of their assets in Switzerland.
And how much money came in?
Well, I brought in several hundred million dollars into Switzerland when I was working as a private banker, and it depends. You can bring it in through multiple accounts or, as I said, existing accounts.
And were you helping people hide their money?
Well, people have to understand, in Switzerland, it was legal to have a numbered account. The problem came is when you crossed outside of Switzerland to go to, say, the United States or Canada, and that's exactly what I challenged with my own legal and compliance department about that fact that this was a problem.
Now, what's in it for the banks? How do they earn money on all these secret accounts?
Well, again, remember, if you're not paying taxes and you're not going to be disclosed, and if, it's, say, you're in a 50% tax bracket, you don't mind paying 3-5% on the account. So you can.
That's a fee?
Oh,
that's
yes.
Imposed?
Absolutely. They impose a fee on custody fees, trading fees, funds, and so forth. And because, remember, if you're at a 50% tax bracket and you're paying 5%, you're saving 45%.
Although 3% on $2.5 million can still add up to a lot of money, but it's a lot less, as you say, than what you'd pay in taxes.
Precisely, and that's what the Swiss did, and they knew it was a one-way street. The money would come into Switzerland, but it would never leave.
And then they also encouraged these people to invest through the bank?
The clients, most of them were very aggressive in trading. And again, insider trading was only illegal, I think around a decade ago. So you had people making a lot of money and not paying any tax on income, capital gains, or inheritance.
But you write that when you're at Barclays, the Barclays suddenly got nervous. Did anyone suspect that hiding money in Swiss accounts might eventually blow up?
I don't think the Swiss ever thought that, because within their confines of their country, they felt so secure. And I think this country has always been that way. The problem is when you have the outside pressure and you have foreign branches in jurisdictions like the U.S. that can put pressure on you to divulge that information.
How do you move $200 million out of one country into another? In the United States, can't you, if you take more than $10,000 out at a time, doesn't that raise red flags?
Well, it certainly does. But the people, the clients, and some of the professionals that worked in the field, the trust officers and attorneys, were very sophisticated, moving monies that were already offshore, whether through a business transaction or some sort of commission or what have you. And that way, it's very hard to trace and track down.
So can you give us an example? There's also money that's hidden in Caribbean banks and elsewhere. Would it be pretty much the same process, or would I have wanted to move my bank, my account to Switzerland ultimately?
Well, Switzerland was politically and economically stable, so clients like that, as well as was in the center of Europe. So
rather than the Bahamas, where there might be an unstable government?
Precisely. And the other thing is that when people, I'll give you an example, a Hollywood actor would do a movie in, say, Hungary, they would get paid $10 million, they would bring $3 million to the U.S. and send $7 million to Geneva and said, I got paid $3 million, when in fact they got paid $10
million. Did you pretend at times that you were setting up a company as a way of covering up some of this money?
Companies were set up. We couldn't set them up personally.
The shell companies?
We couldn't do that within the bank. It was done externally from the bank because they use third-party providers to do that. But we set up companies and trusts and foundations.
Why did Barclays transfer you to its London office?
Well, I actually stopped. I didn't get transferred. I was actually covering the London office from Geneva. So what they wanted to do was stop marketing to the U.S. and Canada. So I started marketing to the prestigious branches in London.
Is it legal to solicit funds in London?
It is. It is, because the Brits can move money and foreigners can move money outside of the U.K. through either capital or income accounts, and that's how they differentiated.
And the money, you say, flowed in.
Oh, it was a waterfall of cash.
Will that all change now with Brexit?
Well, Brexit will certainly affect that, but I think Brexit will go another way where there'll be the next Hong Kong. And if they're smart, they would make it advantageous for people to invest in the UK, because I think people are very scared of the continent and the instability, not only political, but economic.
Now, you said, what do you mean by the next Hong Kong?
Well, Hong Kong was very attractive for people because the taxes were quite low on corporations setting up there, as well as they had resident domicile rates, meaning you would pay very small income tax rates when you were making a lot of money. So that attracted very rich people to stay in London, buy apartments, invest in the country, and that's very attractive, and the ripple effect is quite huge.
Ireland was doing something similar. Why did Ireland wind up with a banking crisis?
Ireland was different because Ireland is more about a pass-through entity, as we say, meaning they would set up structures that would then go flow through, say, Holland and back to Bermuda. They called it a Dutch sandwich. They would set up certain structures for Apple and Hewlett-Packard and these kinds of corporations that would take advantage of the low tax rates in those jurisdictions to set up and shield their taxable income. London was different because it attracted wealth, but also the people who are working and adding to the economy.
I'm speaking with Bradley C. Birkenfeld, who's a retired financial industry professional, and one of history's most significant whistleblowers. We're talking about his book, which is called Lucifer's Banker, The Untold Story of How I Destroyed Swiss Bank Secrecy. It is published by C.S. Lewis and Company. And we will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Bradley C. Birkenfeld, who has written a book called Lucifer's Banker, The Untold Story of How I Destroyed Swiss Bank Secrecy. It's published by C.S. Lewis and Company. While you were at Barclays, you traveled to California to meet Igor Olenikov. Who's he?
He was one of my large clients. He was a Russian real estate billionaire who...
An oligarch? Was he American or was he in Russia?
Well, he was a Russian that emigrated to the States when he was a child. But he had offshore money a decade before I even met him. So he was actually breaking the law long before I met him.
How much money was he looking to hide from the authorities?
Around $200 million.
And he had come buy all of that money legally in real estate?
He was a developer in California, Nevada, and Florida.
Not long after you met with Igor, you were poached by, can we call it poached by UBS?
I would say headhunted, actually. Uh-huh. There's a headhunting firm in London that approached me to work for them to be the head of business development for North America.
And you were a valuable commodity because you knew European banking, but also were an American.
Well, that was it. And I had an economics degree, a master's in finance, as well as work experience at Credit Suisse and Barclays. So they saw that I had the skill set to fit into that mold.
And this is around 2001?
This was. I was recruited in 2000 and signed my contract in 2001.
So did Olenikov transfer his funds to you at UBS?
He opened accounts there at UBS. He did transfer his funds because Barclays in the Bahamas was kicking all Americans out. They were closing the business down. And so he moved his money to Switzerland to continue to hide it from the authorities.
Now, Barclays went through some scandals of its own, but was that later?
Well, I think it's hard to keep track of all the scandals. There's so many with these banks, so it depends which scandal.
For example, there was a money laundering problem that Barclays went through, and a number of the banks had money laundering problems.
It was big. It was big problems. Money laundering and tax evasion, aiding and abetting tax evasion. And the problem is that for years, remember, Barclays was very big in the Caribbean and in the British colonies. So they attracted a lot of wealth that was overseas. So they actually were formidable in that area.
How had you structured Olenikov's money so that it could be hidden from the authorities?
Well, he wanted it to be replicated like he had in the Bahamas. So we introduced him to a trust company in Liechtenstein that set up sophisticated companies and trusts that managed these multiple bank accounts.
So the countries like Liechtenstein also benefit from this. Belize is another one that does. I would think that every small country with a a minimal budget would want to have a bank of its own.
Well, exactly.
Cyprus, another?
Cyprus, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, Singapore, the list goes on. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of these jurisdictions attracting a lot of this money, not just tax evasion, but then it gets into much more nefarious acts such as guns, drugs, prostitution, human trafficking, and so forth.
You write that, I'm quoting, by my fourth year with UBS, I knew I was walking barefoot on the rim of a volcano.
That's right.
You realize that what you were doing could get you in a lot of trouble?
Well, that was it, because the bank was really more interested in protecting themselves and deflecting any blame onto the bankers. So what I did was I felt it was my responsibility as a director to approach my compliance and legal department and report this.
And by 2005, the global war on terror was raging. Private Swiss accounts were involved in funding terrorist activities. Were you beginning to come under more scrutiny for that kind of thing?
Well, I think all banks were coming under the scrutiny. And the thing that bothered me the most was that they, when 9/11 happened and the poor people that have perished because of this horrific attack, I felt as though it was linked to Switzerland because you had no transparency and people taking out cash. And it was actually reported that the mobile phones the terrorists used were purchased in Geneva.
So Osama bin Laden probably had accounts in Switzerland?
Oh, the bin Laden family had billions of dollars at UBS. Now, that's not to say the family's bad, but I think if you're going to start any investigation, you're going to start with family members of the most notorious terrorist in the world.
Were you surprised when you chanced upon a three-page memo entitled Cross-Border Business Banking?
I was. I was shocked by this because I had never seen it before, and I was never trained on it, and it was slipped into our intranet, internal computer system, and brought to my attention by a colleague.
And what was in the memo?
In essence, it contradicted everything we were doing. The bank was promoting us to go to the States quarterly for weeks at a time to meet with prospective clients, go to events, see existing clients, sell products. And this document actually contradicted that. So it was a real eye-opener.
It revealed how UBS planned to cover itself if there was any fallout from the illegal activities that they were encouraging you to pursue?
Well, exactly. A CYA memo, as we call it. And what they were doing was covering their backside, because what they didn't want is if something did go wrong, as you indicate, they could just say, well, you didn't read the memo.
And then they could say you were a rogue banker.
Well, precisely. But they were happily taking the rogue profits.
So here you are. You now realize that you got to do something to protect yourself. But you had a terrible income when you went to the FBI to tell them about State Street. Were you worried about being a whistleblower again?
No, I wasn't, because I knew it was the right thing to do, and I was relentless in my efforts. And I knew that if you're going to do it, you had to do it right, with documentation and eyewitness testimony and understanding exactly what you were doing, and to go to different agencies. I went to multiple agencies on the UBS whistleblowing, which was really the success.
But if you did something, were you breaking these multiple non-disclosure agreements that you had signed when you joined UBS?
No, I did it legally, because I asked the Department of Justice for a subpoena, which they refused to give me. So I went to the United States Senate, who happily gave me a subpoena, which protected me from the Swiss banking laws.
And this is also where Doug, your brother, was helpful?
He was. He was instrumental in working with me and helping me out in that regard.
And you'd been collecting evidence while you were working at UBS?
I had documents that were given to me. I never took any documents. I never tried to sell any documents. These were items that were put in my possession, which I kept.
Went to the Department of Justice in Washington.
That was the first mistake, but yes, I did go to them.
Now, why was that a mistake?
Well, because the Department of Justice likes to get credit. They're a political arm of the government, and they're...
As we've just discovered.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's been going on for decades, unfortunately. And the problem with these people is that they are the problem, not the solution. And they covered up for a lot of these rich millionaires and billionaires when every American, your audience listening today, paid their taxes.
And this, it doesn't matter whether we have a Republican or a Democrat in the White House?
I don't believe it does, actually. I think both sides are as guilty as the other.
Does anyone know at UBS, did they know that you were about to expose their clients?
Well, I had whistleblown internally at the bank first to the board of directors. So they knew that they were on the hook for this. And I used their own whistleblowing policies, but they covered it up. So when that happened, I then decided I had to go to the United States government.
But then I would imagine the IRS would probably understand some of this. But the Department of Justice, do they have anyone equipped to understand the complex ways in which money is hidden in these transactions?
Well, they don't, and that's the problem. They don't want to work with whistleblowers because they don't want to give the credit to the whistleblowers. And the very fact that I had to educate them on this, and the very fact that they still screwed up the investigation to the detriment of every American is appalling.
They screwed up the investigation. Didn't they get billions of dollars out of this whole thing?
They did, but what happens is we had 19,000 accounts just at UBS. Why didn't you indict any of these people? You never saw any big names indicted. You could have got much more money. But the bigger issue here is you could have stopped the worldwide offshore banking, but the U.S. didn't go to the extent they should have gone. Now you have dictators still moving monies around, arms deals being done, terrorist financing, human trafficking. But the U.S. dropped the ball, and this is a real problem.
The Russians as well.
The Russians.
How much Russian money is in Swiss bank accounts?
No one knows the exact numbers.
Because they've described Putin's government as a kleptocracy. And then, of course, we have kleptocracies in other parts of the world, dictators all over the world.
Absolutely.
Just Gambia, just recently, the dictator left with his Rolls Royces and a lot of money.
Well, this is exactly right. You had Marcos, Arafat had his money in Geneva, Gaddafi. The list goes on and on. Bhutto. So I think the problem we have here is that Switzerland for years was harboring these people to the detriment of society.
Well, there's some pretty shady characters with money hidden in Swiss accounts. Were you ever afraid for your life?
No, I wasn't afraid for my life. And I think I've always said to my friends, if you can kill John F. Kennedy in broad daylight 60 years ago, anyone's disposable.
How did the case proceed, since you say that the Department of Justice wasn't completely on your side?
Well, the problem was they were protecting their friends. There were people in the Bush administration who had accounts at UBS. Phil Graham was the vice chairman of UBS here in New York. I mean, this is the most controversial position I could imagine, as well as Robert Wolf, who was very close to President Obama. So really what you have is these people in bed with each other. And big banks with big government is the problem. And we have to put an end to it. And if we don't, you're going to see society suffer.
Why, if you were revealing illegal activities of your own volition, did you end up spending 30 months in jail?
Well, because the Department of Justice is, they're very jealous, and they were very upset because the United States Senate stole the credit. They had hearings on this, massive hearings. And on my website, lucifersbanker.com, you can see all these reports and these interviews and documents, which are damning. And it's amazing that this bank didn't pay a proper fine, nobody else was prosecuted, and they walked away with writing a check.
And do you think that it sends a bad message to future whistleblowers to put someone in jail?
It's a chilling effect. Whistleblowers are an extension of law enforcement. They should be praised, not prosecuted.
What were the charges against you?
It was a one charge. It was this ridiculous charge called a tax conspiracy charge. So you don't need any evidence. You don't need any witnesses. You have to defend yourself against these charges that the government can just levy against you.
Do you feel that you should have spent some time in jail? You were engaged in illegal activities.
No, I don't think I should have, because I was the one, the courageous whistleblower, that came in and exposed the largest tax fraud, and they never would have had this without me coming forward.
And did anyone else ever go to jail?
No.
As of today, $15 billion in taxes and fines have been collected. Was that all from UBS clients?
No, it came from a variety of clients. And what happened is 100,000 people, Americans, came in to disclose their offshore illegal accounts. So you can imagine 100,000 people and over $15 billion was collected because one courageous man came forward and did the right thing.
The investigation you helped initiate also led to the disclosure of the Panama Papers. How much was discovered there?
Well, the Panama Papers is quite different. That was more about structures rather than individual bank accounts. And some corporations offshore are legitimate. But so people have to understand there's a difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance.
Has offshore banking changed since you helped blow the lid off of it?
bank secrecy is over as a result of my actions, as well as the banking sector in Switzerland has condensed by 30% as a result of my actions.
And aren't there new investigations going on about UBS in France and Apple in Ireland?
There are. I'm actually, I testified in an investigation in Paris, and I've been helping foreign governments not only investigate UBS worldwide, but also to change their whistleblowing laws to make them stronger.
Listeners have been writing in. One wonders if you think that Donald Trump might not want to release his taxes because he has hidden money. Would the IRS even know?
Well, if he came in under a voluntary disclosure program, then they would know internally, but that would never be released. Mitt Romney actually had an account at UBS. He got caught having that. And the problem is, this is why the bank was allowed to walk away. They didn't want people talking about the names of these accounts. And Mark Rich's attorney had an account in Switzerland, and they just let these people walk away.
And another listener adds to what you said about Phil Graham, who this listener says is one of the architects of the 2008 crisis, but he's never mentioned in that context, despite having a heavy and fateful hand, I'm quoting the listener, in financial legislation. He's now wrapped in the arms of UBS Investment Banking.
Absolutely. Your writer is correct, because what Phil Graham did was on, I believe, Christmas Eve, he passed the legislation to loosen the regulations, which got us in the mess of 2008. And Phil Graham, being the vice chairman of UBS, you can only imagine what kind of monies he had in compensation with UBS.
And this listener says that UBS is a criminal organization. Would you go that far?
I'd say it's a global criminal organization, and I stand by it.
Now, you did get a nice, healthy sum from the IRS. Was it worth spending 30 months in prison for $104 million?
Well, they were mutually exclusive. I came in and started whistleblowing a year and a half before the law was even passed. So it wasn't about doing it for the money, per se.
I didn't say that. I just said, in retrospect, does it look that way?
In retrospect, yes. I mean, I think nobody's going to turn down $104 million, obviously. But I think what I did was the right thing. And I think it's important for people to understand that whistleblowers help society.
And the book that Bradley C. Birkenfeld has written is called Lucifer's Banker, The Untold Story of How I Destroyed Swiss Bank Secrecy. It is published by C.S. Lewis and Company. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope your listeners are better educated as a result of this.